Welcome to a special discussion episode. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Dan Lindsay.
And today we're going to be talking about the top three historical figures in our personal headcanon. Let's get started. Dan, why have you stolen Joe's seat?
Well, apparently you and Joe are passing the Rona back and
forth. It seems like it. Joe has COVID-19, so if you're of a praying mindset, you can lift up a prayer for him, and we all wish him a speedy recovery. But frequent contributor and all-around historical genius Dan Lindsay has agreed to sit in once again.
I'll pay you for that later.
Yeah. We're going to call this the COVID season because we've got... Hopefully this will be it, but next time we'll be announcing that Dan has COVID. Hopefully not.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. So for those of you who are tuning in for our discussion on Jordan Peterson, that will be next Monday. And hopefully, assuming Joe is feeling better, we'll be back to our regular schedule then. So Dan, how you doing?
Doing well. Yourself?
Good. Doing all right. Can you believe that 2022 is nearby?
No.
It's...
No.
Yeah.
I thought 2020 dragged on forever.
Uh-huh.
And 2021 just forgot to show up.
Yeah, pretty much. It's been an exciting year,
yeah,
to say the least.
Exciting is a word for it.
Yeah, yeah. I started thinking, okay, maybe this will be a better year. And then, bam, January 6th.
January 6th, then supply chain crisis.
And then, yeah, it's been a year.
Yeah.
Anyway, but we're not talking about the present today. We're talking about the past. So I came up with the idea of us just kind of discussing our top three historical figures, the best and the worst that humanity has to offer. So we're just going to dive right in here. So we're going to go from, would it be ascending or descending order?
Ascending order.
Okay. I'm not a math person.
Neither are any of the people we're going to talk about. So,
well, that's very true. So Dan, why don't you start us off? Tell us a little bit about your third ranked best historical figure in the world.
Sure. Sure. First, thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Always a pleasure.
A loaded topic, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, yeah. Hard to pick three, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And hard to define what greatness meant, mm-hmm, as well. And I kind of went around about that for a couple of days.
Yeah.
Number three for me was going to be Caesar Augustus.
Okay. Someone we've talked about on this podcast pretty recently.
Correct,
excellent.
Yeah. And I love the way you summarized his life on that episode.
It was tough to do in 15 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, he accomplished a lot.
Yeah,
he was the first person to unify an empire around an ideal that they kind of were exhibiting, but most definitely most of the time not exhibiting.
Yeah.
He got people fired up about being part of a great empire while executing great tragedies, mm-hmm, along the way.
So. Absolutely. And that idea was? Just the idea of a world-spanning empire, you think?
Yeah, the greatness of Rome.
Right, yeah. Okay. And why do you think that lasted for so long? I mean, the next 200 years, with periodic exceptions, the Pax Romana, and none of his successors were even close to him. So why do you think that great idea, in his terms, survived so long after his death? Because I think one of the elements of this discussion is going to be the long-lasting impact of these individuals.
Absolutely. And if you get to the end of my list, you'll notice they're all very ancient people.
So okay.
There's a long wick that follows,
yeah,
them.
Yeah, absolutely.
The benefit that Caesar Augustus had, that Octavian had, in my estimation, was that he came at the beginning, mm, of a new era. So if you come at the beginning of something, you get a chance to define what that thing is. And so everything else is kind of in your shadow,
yeah,
from that point on. And so, and his longevity, he lived to be what, like 70 or 80 years old?
Almost 80, I think it was 78.
Which at that time, that's three lifetimes,
oh,
essentially.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So he himself spanned three generations of, mm-hmm, Romans. So his natural longevity of his life, I think gave a lot of credence to that as well.
Mm-hmm. What kind of impact do we see stemming from that in our world today, or maybe not today, but over the, you know, centuries after his death, mm, and after even the fall of Rome?
Yeah. Well, where to go to that? Where to go with that one? Which direction?
Yeah.
You anywhere from things as practical as the transportation systems that we enjoy today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, the roads, the systems of roads that he didn't begin, but they definitely grew in popularity in his time.
Absolutely.
So transportation, the idea of what it meant to be a citizen.
Yep.
The Greeks had that, but it didn't carry as much weight as it did in Rome. Mm-hmm. But you had special class if you were a citizen of Rome. So I think that the idea of being a part of something greater than yourself from an empire perspective, we would call it now from a national perspective, Rome pretty much created the first nationalistic movement behind Augustus.
That's true.
Behind Caesar Augustus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're right. The Greeks did have a version of it, but basically there were two distinctions. It was citizen or slave in Greece, whereas Rome, you had citizens. You also had free non-citizens, the Socii, I think they were called. And then you obviously had slaves there as well.
So, John, what's number three on your list?
So it will not surprise anyone who is a regular listener that my third one is German, because I've studied German history, speak the language, have a great affinity for the German nation, not so much these days because of some of their COVID policies. The German health minister recently said that by the end of this coming winter, everyone in Germany will either be vaccinated, recovered, or dead.
Man, they're good separating people into groups.
I'm sitting here going, have you learned nothing from... it's not funny, but at the same time, the historian in me is like, well, okay, here we go again.
Reruns are awesome.
Yeah, yeah. My third one is not anyone from that particular era that we're referencing without directly referencing anybody's name, you know, guy with a little mustache or anything like that. He does not appear on this list. My third greatest figure, in my opinion, is Otto von Bismarck.
Okay, fascinating.
The Iron Chancellor who unified Germany, kind of like Augustus, through sheer like force of personality. Germany had never been unified really ever in its entire history. It had been a collection of principalities and tiny kingdoms loosely governed by the Holy Roman Empire, which, as Voltaire said, was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire.
Those historical ironies.
Yes, that goes away in 1804, and about 60 years later, Bismarck gets this idea that we want a national Germany unified under the idea of Prussian militarism. He launches a series of wars against Denmark, Austria, and ultimately France. And by so doing, he forms Germany into this militaristic state, this expansionist power that has the idea of we want to be a Weltmacht. We want our place in the sun. We want to be a world power, which, as you know, and as you know, even casual students of history know, lead to two world wars, lead to any number of tragedies and upheavals across history. But it really did kind of start with Otto von Bismarck.
And where did he draw inspiration from?
Frederick the Great was his primary inspiration. Also, Niccolo Machiavelli, in terms of how he operated. Machiavelli, author of The Prince during the early Renaissance period, basically said, remove morality from politics. If it is good for your leader, if it is good for you, do it. Mm. And this idea of realpolitik very much inspired and drove Bismarck to do some pretty shady things. I mean, even after he came to power, in addition to starting his wars, he suppressed ruthlessly Catholics and socialists. Because he thought, well, they're disloyal to the emperor, even though they're out there proclaiming, no, we are loyal to Wilhelm I. He's saying, yeah, not loyal enough. And so he's throwing them in prison and expelling them. And a lot of them came to the United States as a result. But those were the two figures, Frederick the Great of Prussia for his military genius and just kind of sheer ballsiness. I mean, at one point, Frederick the Great is at war with all of Europe, and he's got Russian armies marching in on one side, Polish armies, Danish, Swedish, French, some British troops. He is surrounded, and yet he is able, because of his military genius and the strength of German of Prussian soldiers, he's able to win. Hmm. So Bismarck thought, well, I can do that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and what effect did his legacy have, fast forwarding to the 20th century, on people like Adolf Hitler?
Well, Hitler very much considered himself to be a leader in the mold of Bismarck. When he first came to power before the war, before really any Nazi policies were initiated, I think it was in February or March of 1933, just after the Reichstag fire, there is a church ceremony in the garrison church at Potsdam, which is like the spiritual center of Prussian nationalism and Prussian and German militarism. It's where a lot of the kings are buried, and the German president, Paul von Hindenburg, kind of the last of the great field marshals of World War I. Mm-hmm. He's there. Hitler is there. And there's a slogan on these pamphlets that are handed out to the German people who are able to come and watch this thing. It was something to the effect of, what the Iron Chancellor created and the field marshal defended, the Führer will now consecrate. So there's a direct line in Hitler's mind between Bismarck, Hindenburg, the field marshal turned president, and now the Chancellor, eventually becoming the Führer, the three of them are basically part of the continuity of German history. And a lot of historians, until very recently, have drawn that very same link. And it goes back to Frederick the Great and really all the way back to Martin Luther, this idea of the Sonderweg, the special path, that Germany was kind of destined for this great rise and traumatic fall. It was destined to be a country that would just completely upend the table settings in Europe, and certainly did that.
Yeah, well, yeah. At least tried to.
Or tried.
Four times.
Yeah.
Well, that brings up an interesting point as well. Some of the greatest people in history have also been some of the most fantastical storytellers.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been able to weave themselves, whether it's Augustus or whether it's Otto von Bismarck, whether it's Adolf Hitler, whether it's Napoleon, whoever it is, they've been able to latch on to they've been able to latch on to a meta narrative, like a larger story, and insert themselves rightly, wrongly, appropriately, inappropriately into that and say, this is what we're accomplishing.
Oh, yeah.
This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating.
Yep. And there are a lot of people who, a lot of very like populist leaders. I think of Andrew Jackson. Mm. He was able to do the exact same thing when he came to the White House. This populist movement that was starting in the wake of the War of 1812 and kind of America's growing, it's becoming, it's finding its footing. And Jackson's like, I'm going to take the lead in that. And he turned himself, even though he was fantastically rich, had no interest in actually listening to the people. He turned himself into a man of the people with that same narrative. All right. And your second figure, you're the ancient historian. I'm doing more modern people, but that's a good balance.
Yeah. I like it. One of these days we should do a talk on the most influential writers or artists.
Oh, for sure.
Because that's a subgenre in and of itself.
Yep. Yeah, I think all of ours are like politicians and military leaders and things like that. But yeah,
I thought about throwing Catherine de' Medici in there just to make things interesting. Man. But I was like, nah, we're not going to go down that road.
Yeah, she was
colorful.
Yeah.
So second on my list, we're going back in time. I would have to say Aristotle.
Mm. Not Socrates or Plato.
Not Socrates or Plato. Okay. Just because the I would give preference to Plato.
Mm-hmm.
The Republic was one of the most influential pieces of literature in my life.
Yeah.
In how to understand government, how to understand civic duty, what morality and ethical conduct within a society looks like.
Mm-hmm.
The Republic is by far probably my favorite ancient work. At the same time, and I'll go back to how I defined the greatest people in history, because I think that matters. People who have the most wide-ranging effect on human society even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the three of them, whether it's Aristotle, Socrates, or Plato, Aristotle by far, I think, had the most long-lasting effect on not only what people in the philosophical realm or the religious realm considered important, but how they structured their thoughts, how they thought. He was the first person really to organize things into sciences.
Yep.
And we can debate the accuracy of those sciences, but it's for him, the method was the important thing. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's talking about rhetoric or dialectic in the way you speak, or whether it's dividing the physical sciences from the metaphysical sciences, he defined a method of organizing one's thoughts to accomplish really whatever you wanted to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Would you say that, because I think it was Victor Davis Hanson, the great classicist, basically, he didn't criticize Aristotle for this, but he basically said Aristotle is standing on the shoulders of giants. He's basically taking Plato plus Socrates, putting them together and creating the modern world. Would you say that that's accurate, or did Aristotle add in any new ideas or different ideas to kind of challenge his two mentors?
I think it's a both and.
Yeah.
I think he definitely stood on the shoulders of Socrates and Plato. At the same time, don't we all?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, I'm hesitant, and we talked about this before the broadcast. It's like, I'm hesitant to say that he was not great because he did not have his own original ideas, or nothing actually started with him. We know from Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
a lot of times what establishes somebody as great in the eyes of history is not the person necessarily that came up with the idea, but the one that made it work. Or the one that's
like deeply profound. Right. So true. Yeah. Well, you're right.
And Aristotle made it work. Mm-hmm. And not only did he make it work, he was more prolific as a writer.
Oh, yeah.
Than Plato and Socrates. So he got the word out.
Or maybe more of it survived the destruction of the library at Alexandria.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
But no, you're right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as far as what we have, certainly he was more prolific.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he managed not to be forced to commit suicide by ingesting hemlock like Socrates before. So he survived long enough to have a great body of work. He wasn't as provocative.
Yes.
Is there something to be said for, especially writers and great thinkers, that they should maybe moderate not their ideas, but their tone so that they're not, so they're able to appeal to a broader audience? You know, because Socrates was basically like, it's my way or the highway. And the sophists and the people of Athens are like, well, get out of here. They ostracized him and then they killed him.
Exactly. Well, I think for all of Socrates's wisdom, he lacked tact.
Oh, yeah.
And so
you read some of his dialogues and man,
it's like, man, you should have really read the room differently.
Yeah.
A little
bit.
Yeah. Read the stadium better. But
the Agora.
Yeah. The Agora. So, I think that that's a fair point. Mm-hmm. I think it's also fair to say that it's also helpful, extraordinarily helpful. If you as a writer or any kind of artist who are going to be pushing the social boundary, it's very, very helpful for you to have a patron.
Mm.
Okay. So think of anybody who challenges the norms of society. You can't go at it alone or you end up like Socrates.
Yep.
Okay. Even people in the 1800s, I'm thinking of Jonathan Edwards. He had somebody who financed his work.
Yep.
He had someone who largely funded his projects. So he didn't go at it alone. And he was breaking boundaries in the U.S. He was breaking boundaries in Protestantism and in Reformed theology that were not as popular as we may think they were today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the guy I mentioned, Voltaire, he was another one. He right. would not have been able to do, I mean, most of his writing is garbage, but
Candide it was hilarious.
It is. But his writings would not have reached, and his ideas would not have reached the kind of audience without his friendship with Frederick the Great. So yeah. You got this. And even, I mean, we were talking before we started. Yeah. Martin Luther, another one who had to have some kind of a patron in order to really get started, like Edwards and like many others.
Yeah. Otherwise, we would not have had half of the works that Luther wrote because he was dead.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think was Aristotle's most influential work, both then and now? I confess I've read like 6 or 7 of his works out of, what, 200-300?
Yeah, I've read a handful, and to my shame, it's been a while.
Okay.
So I don't know if I would necessarily put a label on his most influential work per se. Mm-hmm. I think the power in his legacy rests in the ideas.
Okay.
That he continued through the work of Plato and Socrates, but he also was able to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
He really organized and brought into the popular philosophical conversation this idea of the logos.
Mm.
The overarching controlling mechanism by which the universe operates.
Yeah.
I think more than any individual work of his, I think that idea transcends his entire corpus of work.
When I was in college, a history of religion professor made the argument that without Aristotle and his ideas and his system of organization, and specifically his idea of the logos, Christianity would not have been able to spread as quickly, because the Greek-minded people of the Roman world, which was pretty much everyone, would not have been able to understand this idea of faith and reason, the concept of God come to earth, because that was not part of Roman religion or Greek religion or anything like that in the manner that Jesus did come to earth. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree 100%. I would also add to it, I don't think they would have even cared.
No, that's true.
Because think of it, the 3 centuries leading up to the birth of Christ, between Aristotle and the birth of Christ, there was an entire philosophical conversation going on in the Greco-Roman world. And few enough people cared about this new upstart religion coming from Judea in the first place, with this conversation going on. Paul himself said he would go first to the synagogues, and then he would go to the Agora, to the where the philosophers were. And he would have these conversations. If it wasn't for Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates, those conversations would not have had a place to actually take place. Or if they did, they would have been fundamentally different.
Yeah.
All right, so John, jumping back to the post-Roman world, who's your number two?
My second one, you're going to notice a theme with my three, is Charlemagne.
Mm.
Emperor of the Romans after 800 AD, King of the Franks from 778, I believe it was, to 814. Towering figure in the history of Europe. Most people call him the father of Europe because he was building on Augustus. He defined the modern nation state as one with a powerful centralized leader, an efficient bureaucracy, a strong education system, a powerful military. I mean, those are kind of the key elements, and a unified culture. Those are kind of the key elements of a modern nation state. And he's able to bring together what is today much of Germany with most of France, the Low Countries, Northern Italy, unify them into what was then called Christendom, this unified Latin-speaking empire grounded in Christianity, merging the Greco-Roman traditions and culture with those of the post-Roman Germanic kingdoms. He basically hauled Europe out of the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages, that phrase, really only applies to about the first three centuries of what is now known as the Middle Ages or the medieval period. And it was Charlemagne and the Carolingian Renaissance that he created that really sparked that. His wars, obviously, were also a key element of his career, and certainly more controversial than some of his more benign changes. His wars of evangelism were basically convert or die. It was very similar to Crusades, very similar to medieval jihads in the Muslim world. But he gave us Europe and therefore gave us really the Western world that we live in today.
Yeah. And he's a very complicated figure, Charlemagne.
Oh, yes.
And he's one that's always fascinated me because he was this dichotomy of the Gallic tribal leader who wanted to be the great man, the mm-hmm. great emperor.
Yeah.
So talk to me about his relationship with Rome, because he came, as you mentioned, around the sunset of Rome.
Mm-hmm. Well, he came three centuries after the fall of Rome. So in terms of him claiming the title Emperor of the Romans, it was a title conferred on him by the Pope, who at this time is head of what would be known as the Papal States. But there was no Roman Empire in the West. Now, there was an Eastern Roman Empire, and it was certainly controversial that he was naming himself Emperor of the Romans when the Eastern emperors are going, hey, there already is an Emperor of the Romans. So you have to go back at least to his grandfather and really all the way back to his ancestor Clovis about a century and a half earlier. The Franks and the Romans shared a common enemy. It was a group called the Lombards, who are in northern Italy. The Lombards were constantly attacking Rome. They sacked Rome, I think, like 8 times in the span of a century. So Rome, the city of Rome, is in very serious trouble. Clovis converts to, when he becomes a Christian, he converts to Orthodox Christianity. This is pre any kind of split. So there is only one Christian church rather than Arianism, which is the old heresy that Jesus was not actually it was not God. He was a created being dealt with in 325 at the Nicene Creed, or with the Nicene Creed. He converts to real Christianity and he signs an alliance with the Pope, and every Frankish king from Clovis to Charlemagne confirms that. So we there's this very, very strong spiritual and political and military bond between Aachen, the imperial capital, the Frankish capital, and Rome. And that kind of, I almost use the term axis. It's not a, in modern parlance, not a great political term to use, but it really is this line between the city of Aachen in today far western Germany and, you know, the great city of Rome defines Frankish history, French history, German history for the rest of the Middle Ages. Because whoever is king of the Franks, whoever is the leader of what becomes the nation of France, has to protect Rome. And it makes France, until the 15th century with the rise of Spain, it makes France the most Catholic, the most zealous Christian country anywhere in the world. As Christianity continues to expand its reach across Eurasia, down into Africa, people are increasingly looking to France rather than to the various minor countries in Italy as the center of gravity in the Christian world. And Charlemagne is really the one who creates that, all the while acting in a most unchristian manner in his relationships with women and certainly in his wars. He's very Christian in terms of he's funding priests being educated, he's building churches and chapels and cathedrals all over the all over the kingdom. But as soon as he puts on his armor and picks up his sword, it's like, all right, I'm going to lay aside my Christianity, pick up my sword, and kill anyone who disagrees with me on politics, on religion, on anything else. So yeah, like you said, a great dichotomy, a great man of mysteries. And the subject of a really cool death metal band called, I'm going to look up the name of it, but Sir Christopher Lee, the actor famous for Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and things like that. He sings.
Christopher Lee sings metal?
He sings death metal about Charlemagne.
What?
Yes.
Why do I not know this? Saruman, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so the album is literally just called Christopher, the artist is just Christopher Lee, but he's working with a death metal band, and he's singing about, like, my favorite song is called The Massacre of the Saxons, and the chorus is just Christopher Lee repeating over and over, I shed the blood of Saxon men, I shed the blood of Saxon men.
That is excellent.
You need to find it.
Because, I will,
yeah,
yes.
It's very interesting. Now, it's not, like, super hardcore death metal, but it is technically in that...
Yeah,
in that genre. So Charlemagne has crossed from a historical figure to a figure of, you know, pop culture.
Wow. Well, that's fantastic. Like, yeah. Kind of like David Hasselhoff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then there's one other point about Charlemagne, and that is what happens after his death. So he dies in 814. His son, he only has one son because he disposed of several other ones to ensure that there would be only one ruler that succeeded him, because Frankish custom said you divide your kingdom among all of your sons. Well, he didn't want to divide his kingdom, so he could change the law or he could kill off his kids, which is pretty horrifying. It's Again, awful. Not a Christian thing to do. Yeah. And his son, Louis, known as Louis the Pious, has four sons. And so jumping ahead to, I believe it was in 840, when Louis dies, all four sons immediately go to war with each other. They had spent the latter part of their father's reign fighting him, and they attacked each other. One of the sons is killed. Pepin was his name. And the other three, Lothar, Louis, and Charles, are all fighting for the throne. And eventually in 843, we get a treaty signed in the city of Verdun that splits the empire into West Francia, Middle Francia, and East Francia. West Francia becomes France. East Francia becomes Germany. Middle Francia, known as the Middle Kingdom, is basically that line from Aachen to Rome. It's the Low Countries,
the Alsace,
Alsace-Lorraine, and the Rhineland, and then Switzerland and northern Italy. And if you look at every military conflict between France and Germany from 843 to 1945, every single one of them is, at least in part, started over control of that Middle Kingdom. So you want to talk about direct impact for the next 1,002 years right there. It started with their grandpa, Charlemagne.
Yeah. Well, he's a fascinating figure because he, depending on how you understand medieval conversions, from a religious perspective, talk to us about how we can understand him as a quote-unquote Christian person.
It's tough because we are commanded in Scripture not to judge hearts and minds, and we've made that point in this podcast repeatedly, but we can judge fruit. And Charlemagne's fruit is, as I said, very, very mixed. Not much has survived of his own writings. It's mostly what other people have written about him. I think there are a few fragments of some poetry that he composed, which is really, really tough to read and tough to understand, because Charlemagne learned to write and read as an adult.
Yeah, he was illiterate for most of his life.
He was, and he's one of the very few European leaders who learned to write and read as an adult. So he's not very loquacious, you might say. So what we have is either accounts written by his enemies that he is this monster, obviously not a Christian, there's nothing good in this man. One of them calls him, one of the leaders of the Saxons, calls him the man with the black heart. And then you have monks and popes and bishops and court historians singing his praises, that he is the greatest person since Jesus Christ. One of the... there was an Italian monk who wrote a lament for Charlemagne at his death, and it ends with, O Charles, O Christ, what have you done? Christ meaning, you've taken him from us. Alas for miserable me. When he died, most of the empire that he ruled just went into this bitter mourning, like, how are we going to live without this man? That gave him a tremendous ego, and he already had an ego because he's a Frankish king.
Yeah.
So the short answer is, I don't know whether he was a believer. There's really no way for us to know for sure. I would say by his actions, his Christianity, his conversion was probably political in order to get that crown and raise himself above the other kings of Europe.
Wanted to keep the Pope from attacking him.
Well, the Pope wasn't going to attack him. the Pope didn't have a whole lot of strength at this point, but the Pope might give another king that title of emperor, because there was a movement in the century before him. We need to have a Roman emperor again, even though there is no more Rome in terms of the empire. That title should continue. We don't want these Easterners who have their very weird version. Again, there's only one church, but the Easterners are already developing what becomes Orthodoxy. The Westerners are developing Catholicism. We don't want this Easterner who doesn't believe in the supremacy of the Pope to be emperor of the Romans. So we're going to create our own.
Yeah. So what impact does a figure like Charlemagne have on the cultural history of Europe? You mentioned some of the geopolitical effects of his rule and how those are... and how those have lasted even into the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to culture, art, how Europeans see themselves, what kind of legacy does he leave?
Well, there was no single distinct European culture before Charlemagne. Even if you didn't live in his empire, basically the entire continent that was still under Christian rule was affected by him because he patronized the arts so much, and he would just send gifts of artwork. He would send bags of cash to a town to build a new cathedral or to build a new church or something like that in areas outside his control. He was hoping, I think, ultimately to expand, to control all of the continent of Europe. He wasn't all that concerned with Great Britain or with Scandinavia, but the mainland of Europe, he wanted at least to be influential, be the most influential person. So that is a huge element of his cultural impact. The other part, in addition to patronage and spreading this idea of Christendom, is he paid scribes to copy as much ancient knowledge as possible. One of the reasons why we have so much of Aristotle, why we have so much of the great Roman writers like Cicero and Marcus Aurelius, is because all across Europe, these guys are copying stuff. And again, you have to do it by hand. You know, there's obviously no kind of technology. So when the Vikings come 2 centuries after and they burn like almost every monastery in France, there are still enough copies around and enough people who know how to write, who know how to continue to copy this stuff down, that these sources of knowledge, these sources of culture survive. Because the Vikings, and then you got the Mongols coming in from the other side, would have destroyed as much of European culture as they could. There's evidence. I mean, we know that they did.
Yeah.
Had it not been for Charlemagne or someone like him saying, we got to write this stuff down, European culture would look very, very different.
Yeah.
So, Dan, before we talk about our top historical figures, let's do 2 honorable mentions each. People who you wanted to put on there, but they didn't quite make the grade.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll call them honorable mentions, but...
Or dishonorable.
It wasn't because they didn't make the grade. It was because I intentionally left out religious figures.
Okay.
In my mind, the top most influential person in the history of the world is Christ.
Right.
But he was God, so he gets a leg up. That's not fair.
Yeah. That's true.
So
I was thinking about that. It's like, okay, neither of us has mentioned, we've mentioned him in passing, but yeah, he really should be at the top of both of our lists.
Exactly, yeah. So left him out, and the same goes for my number 2, it would be the Buddha.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yep, my 2 would be both 2 villains who had a tremendous impact on our world, Vladimir Lenin and Adolf Hitler, because we're living in the world that they created. Not figures to emulate, not figures to admire by any means, but certainly important and influential. All right, greatest figure in all of world history, Dan, in your opinion?
I would have to go, and I went back and forth on this. I would have to go with Alexander the Great.
Really? Not, I guess you're doing ancient figures, so okay, all right. I'm thinking there are a lot of, it's just an interesting choice. Tell us why.
Yeah. So in keeping with the theme of who got there first, we would not have the Rome that we know of today would not have been the Rome that it was without Alexander's conquest for the Greeks. He basically, by the time I think he was, what, 20, How old was he when he reached India?
He was 26, 27.
Okay.
I think he died at 33.
Yeah,
I think it was about 4 years 20s.
There. Yeah, so yeah. 27 years old. So from the time he took the throne from his father until the age of 26, 27, he conquered an area of land larger than in width than the United States.
Mm-hmm. Without planes or tanks or anything like that.
Without planes, without tanks,
guys on
foot. Not even a lot of horse travel.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the travel done by Greek soldiers at that time was on foot. Horses were not used in battle.
Mm-hmm.
They were used as pack animals. So they would oftentimes send the horses ahead a little bit, but mostly the horses were in the rear.
Yeah.
In the rear with the gear. So, yeah. I think anybody, and to add to his contribution, Aristotle had a profound effect.
Yep.
Well, arguably had a profound effect on not only Alexander's leadership style,
mm-hmm.
but the way he viewed the world. And so I think you can take a lot of, I think you can take a lot away from the relationship that Aristotle and Alexander the Great had,
mm-hmm.
and draw a causal relationship between the instruction he received at the hands of Aristotle and others like him, and the effect that that had on his leadership ability while he was in command.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, he certainly spread Aristotle's ideas, I mean, everywhere, far beyond the borders of Greece. the whole concept of Hellenization, having, you know, merging of Greek and non-Greek or barbarian cultures, was crucial, not just to Western history, but to world history. It leached into India, it made its way to China and influenced those cultures.
Well, and it dominated cultures like Persia.
Oh yeah.
So those it was almost
even after the Greeks were gone. Yeah.
Right. It was almost as if this was the Western world making its mark on world history,
mm-hmm.
not just being relegated to the West. This was the West exerting its influence, shall we say, through invasion, of course.
Yeah.
But onto the Eastern world, onto mm-hmm. the old world, the Mesopotamian mm-hmm. world. This was the secular Greeks invading the land of the Bible, invading the land yep. of the spiritual, of the pagans. So that idea, I think it was very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that has always bugged me about Alexander the Great
mm-hmm.
is the way his kingdom was divided after he departed yeah. this world.
Yep. Yeah, it is an interesting what if. Joe's not here, so I can't hit him with a shoe for. I'm bringing up the what if anyway. If that had not happened, if Alexander the Fourth had survived and been able to rule a united Greek Empire, how would Rome have handled that? Because it would have been very, very different, I think.
Again, I think it would have been very, very difficult for Rome to get off the ground.
Yeah.
Because they would have perpetually been in a very mighty Grecian shadow.
Yeah.
I think splitting Greece up into quadrants diversified the loci of power
mm-hmm.
so much that it gave opportunity for the Latins to continue to build upon their society.
Yeah. Yeah, they were able to get a hold of the Greek Palaeus in the south of Italy, which... that's the economic engine of Italy,
mm-hmm.
of Rome during the wars with Carthage.
Right.
And so, you're right. That would be very, very difficult for them to really expand beyond the borders of Italy
yeah.
in that circumstance.
But and even when you look at the Julio-Claudian dynasty and the establishment of it,
mm-hmm.
Egypt and the might that they had played a massive role in the establishment of the mythology of that line of emperors.
Oh, absolutely.
The conflict between Octavian and Mark Antony, or that conflict that asked the question and answered it definitively, who holds the reins of Rome?
Mm-hmm.
That you talk about going back to the beginning of when we talked about Octavian and his, what led to him being so influential. The mythology of how Rome started is extremely powerful and gives extremely good validity to that line.
Yeah. All coming out of an empire that Alexander built.
Yeah.
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 Interesting. Because again, going back to that same religious history lecture, Alexander the Great came up, and this professor said, without Koine Greek, the Greek that Alexander spoke, Christianity could not have spread as quickly as it did, because everyone spoke it, from St. Paul to, you know, several of the disciples, a lot of the early missionaries. Would you agree with, again, would you agree with that statement?
I would 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
Without the Septuagint, Jews that were living outside of Judea would not have a connection to their home religion.
Yeah.
And so, again, the necessity for them to care about who this Nazirite was would not have been there. Mm-hmm. It would have looked very different.
Yeah.
So, John, drum roll. In your ineffably perfect historical mind, who is your number one historical figure?
If I wanted to change the whole course, not just of European or Western, but of world history with a time machine, and I could only do it once, I would go back to 1788, and I would put myself in Paris, and I would tell King Louis XVI, do not dismiss Jacques Necker, your finance minister. Louis XVI is my top figure because of his massive, massive mistakes and the influence they had on subsequent Western history. Jacques Necker was a financial genius. He wasn't perfect. He worshipped the ground that the king walked on. His personal life was we could do a whole podcast just on just on that. But he was a financial wizard. He knew that France is descending into an economic recession the likes of which we in the United States and really anywhere in the world cannot understand. In France, you have three classes. The first and the second estate, make up collectively 2% of the population, and they hold 90% of the wealth, and they are not taxed one bit. I'm sorry, the bottom 98% of the population pays 100% of the taxes with only 10% of the wealth. The opulence and the lavish lifestyles of the French elites in 1788, 1789 is what leads to the French Revolution. It costs Louis XVI his head, costs his wife her head, costs his son his health, and ultimately his death. And it unleashes across Europe and the world ideas like nationalism, ideas like collectivism, ideas like the cult of reason that literally have touched the lives of every person listening to this podcast and every person drawing breath in the world today. The French Revolution had to come, but it did not have to come in the violent, it is an orgy of violence over the course of certainly the first couple of years of the revolution. It leads to the rise of the strongman Napoleon, who then exports revolutionary ideas across Europe. From there, you get the Restoration when Napoleon is finally defeated. And they suppress these ideas. Some of the ideas are debatably good. Nationalism is not fundamentally wrong. The ideas of liberty, equality, brotherhood coming out of the American Revolution of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, spread across Europe and across the wider world, leading to ultimately the idea that slavery is a universal evil, that political oppression should never be done. The idea of an equality among all people and among all nations, certainly to the good, but the ideas of collectivism, the ideas of the cult of reason, this idea that there is nothing divine outside of mankind, that has led to, I think, the three great isms of the 19th and 20th centuries that have ruined so many lives: Darwinism, socialism, and Nazism. All three can be directly traced back to the outbreak of the French Revolution. If Louis XVI had listened to Jacques Necker and said, you know what, priests and nobles, if you want to continue to enjoy these privileges by being alive, you've got to start paying your fair share. I sound like Bernie Sanders, but I think it is objectively not your fair share when you're paying 0% and you have 90% of the wealth. I mean, yeah. So that would be, he would be my number one historical figure because his mistakes had such a profound influence on the rest of human history.
Well, and that's fascinating because usually when people think of great historical figures, they think of people based upon their accomplishments, what they did well, what they did right. But what I hear you saying is that you can be as equally impactful of a historical figure because of what you do wrong.
Absolutely.
And we've seen that over and over again in the 20th century specifically.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
When Louis the 16th came to power, what was the state of France then?
It was, it had been in debt since Louis the 14th. His great, great grandfather, I believe it was.
The Sun King.
Yeah, the Sun King.
Great brewery, by the way.
True. Louis had built Versailles. He had elevated the nobles to such a position where they didn't have to pay taxes and things like that. So France is deeply in debt. Louis the 16th chooses to back the United States in the War of Independence. Not because he particularly cared about the Americans. It was just a way for him to get back at the British after the defeat his father suffered in the Seven Years' War. And it bankrupted the country. I mean, France had literally no money. I mean, the treasury vaults in Paris were empty. And he just kept on spending. He kept borrowing and spending. And he continued to live this wonderful life. And he had no either knowledge or care for the suffering of his people.
And he would borrow from the church, correct?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
So what impact did that have on the associations of the Catholic Church and the opulence that have been present for centuries in the Catholic Church among the minds of the French people?
It's why we get the civil constitution of the clergy under the Jacobins, where they dispossess the church of all of its lands. They seize every church, every cathedral. All church property is confiscated by the state. The Catholic Church is formally disestablished. France is secularized for the first time. And it converts to the cult of reason, which is basically, I mean, you would call it the culmination of secular humanism, where literally I am the greatest good in this world, and I'm going to worship reason. And by that, I mean, I'm going to do whatever my brain tells me is the most fun. Hmm. And that permanently damages, it permanently breaks the relationship between France and the Catholic Church. Not necessarily the French people, because when Napoleon comes to power a decade later, and reestablishes Catholicism, not with the same level of privileges, but at least allows the church to reclaim its churches and its cathedrals and things like that. Most French people who had survived the Reign of Terror and the subsequent wars and everything like that, they immediately returned to the church. But the political power that the Catholic Church wielded in France was gone pretty much forever. There was a brief resurgence under the restored Bourbons between the First and Second Empire, but it did not last. And it's one of the reasons why France is the most secularized state in Europe today. Most European countries today still have official churches. You don't have to be a member. It's not like in the Middle Ages where you're executed if you're not part of the, you know, Anglican Church or the Church of Denmark or something like that. But in France, there is no official religion. And I think that's partially because of the unimaginable amount of corruption that existed in France before the revolution. The French have long historical memories. Mm. And one of the things I admire about that country, I mock them mercilessly at times, but I admire the fact that the French have such a deep knowledge of and respect for their own history and the history of Europe and the history of the world. And I think that's reflected in the position of the church in France today.
Fascinating.
So Dan, what was something that stood out to you as you were preparing for this? Just kind of a general maybe lesson that our listeners can take away from this.
Yeah, I think the most difficult part in preparing for this conversation was, again, going back to defining what makes a historical figure great.
Mm-hmm.
What are the criteria? Is it, and we've even seen a variance of what that means in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that you overcame tremendous suffering and accomplished something great in your life and that impacted society as a whole? Is it that you wrote something that we are still talking about today, mm-hmm. or you wrote many things that we're still talking about today? Is it that you conquered an entire continent? Is it that you built a system of roads that we still use today? Or the concept of which we still use today, or those roads were used to bring the message of the gospel across the entire Western world. What does it mean
mm-hmm.
to be great? Can you be infamous and historically great? And I think that's a fascinating concept and something that we as individuals should always reflect on when we judge historical characters
mm-hmm.
and honestly, when we judge our own impacts on the communities around us. What will we be known for?
Yep.
And why does that matter?
Absolutely. Yeah, that leads nicely into what I would, the thing that really stood out to me. I looked at, you know, kind of the historical lists of, you know, greatest figures in history to try and narrow mine down. But I kept coming back to everyone on these lists started the same way you and I started. We were born, we grew up. Some people, some men and women throughout history have chosen to make a huge mark on the entire world. Other people make a huge mark on their local communities, on their families, and things like that. And I go back to, I think it was Shakespeare. Some men are born great and some have greatness thrust upon them. I think that if there's a lesson to be learned from the study of history and especially the study of biographies, which is kind of the theme of this season, it's you don't have to aspire to greatness on the historical scale. If you aspire to greatness in your own life, if you aspire to have a positive impact in your community, on your family, your friends, and things like that, you may find yourself with the opportunity to ultimately be great on the world stage. But even if you're not, you have still had a tremendous positive impact. You have still had a tremendous impact on the people who know you and love you. And we should all work to make that impact a positive one.
Amen.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of great historical figures. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Dan Lindsay.
As I said, we'll be back with regular episodes and Joe's triumphant return next week. Until then, please leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. If you would like to help us make it even better, you can go to 15minutehistorypodcast.org and click the support button. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.